I'll just offer a few brief comments, really, conscious that I'm coming at the end of an eminent panel, and I'm sure we all want to have the opportunity to talk and question Patrick and Ottolien in greater detail. So just a sort of few reflections, really, on what we've heard. I haven't got any slides because I thought I'd react in part to what we heard this evening. So firstly, just some thoughts on how these new structures, the OSTS and the Ministerial Council, fit within the wider system of SDI R&D policymaking and strategy in the UK. I think firstly, it's very welcome to hear Patrick elaborate in a bit more detail what the role of the new OSTS will and won't cover. Obviously, as an initiative, it's sort of rather, at least to those of us outside the inner sanctums of Whitehall, sort of dropped out of the sky when it landed, seemingly driven by a Daily Telegraph column that the Prime Minister was writing that Monday. But we haven't really understood very clearly much of the detail of what it is going to do, how it is going to work. So I think any moves to try and explain its function and sort of modus operandi to the wider system would be very welcome. And tonight, of course, is an important part of that. I think, of course, the addition of the OSTS to the system is a familiar dynamic in terms of creating stronger central government structures and then moving responsibilities elsewhere. And it's very reminiscent in some ways of debates around the Rothschild report, more than 50 years ago now, which David, of course, also wrote very well about in his book a few years ago. We have this constant sort of question about how we deal with central government oversight of the system, elements of the R&D system, which are more closely aligned to government priorities. And I think, in line with the additional spending commitments we saw in the spending review in November, with a palpable uplift to non-UKRI government R&D elements, as well as obviously to UKRI and other things, it's good to accompany that, I think, with clearer, stronger structures to try and shape that investment and the policy behind it in sensible ways. So there's clearly lots here that's potentially welcome. I think there is still a need, even on top of what we've heard tonight, to understand a little bit more about the lines between the OSTS, UKRI. Obviously, we've heard a bit from Ottolien on that, but then the other role of the minister in Bays and the structures that remain there, bodies like the CST. Certainly the addition of these structures has made the explaining the UK system that little bit more complicated. I periodically give lectures on how the R&D policy structures work in the UK, and adding these further elements to the mix does complicate things, and I think there's good and there's bad that comes with that. I feel overall in UK research and innovation policy in the past few years, we've had, and I've said this in other things I've written, I feel we've had too much emphasis on tinkering with structures and institutions and not enough on outcomes. And I'm sure probably Patrick and Ottolien would agree with that. But it does feel like we have come through a lot of structural changes to how we are trying to do policy in this domain and strategy. And I think it would be welcome to have a period of stability to allow those structures to bed down. I think we're also still left with a little bit of a gap in understanding when they're up and running and working at their full capacity, as it were, how these different responsibilities within the system will work. Many of us welcomed the announcement now, I suppose, 18 months ago, of the R&D roadmap process, which was initiated by Bays and others. And that seemed at least an attempt to try and pull the different strands together in a more coherent strategy that the rest of us could sort of read and digest and understand. And I think it was disappointing that seemingly, again, this is obviously talking from outside, that roadmap sort of led us didn't lead us very far, shall we say, that the destination was never fully reached and that it was a process that began but was never completed. And I think it would be very welcome, many people have said this, of course, to see through a combination of UKRI's new strategy, which I understand is imminent, and efforts of the OSTS and others to try and create at least a clearer sense for the next 5 years of how these different elements of the system do function effectively together. None of us is looking for sort of a Chinese style 5-year plan, but we do need, I think, a little bit more sort of visible coordination, or at least sense of how it is being coordinated. I'm sure it feels more coordinated inside than it does to those of us looking at it from further flung places like Sheffield. So that was my first point. And I think linked to that, there is this, and this debate ran around Rothschild, so again, it's nothing new, this debate about the balance between central coordination of SDI policy and strategy and more distributed collective intelligence across the system. I think there's been so much interesting thinking going on in recent years about notions of distributed intelligence through systems, people like Jeff Mulgan at UCL now doing a lot of great work in this area. And I feel, you know, if we can't do that in the R&D system, then where can we, given that we have an enormous army of hyper-intelligent people working in the system? I do feel that we need to, when we set up new structures, we need to really invest seriously in the softer mechanisms and infrastructures to enable those to tap into and draw on that much more dispersed, diffuse mode of expertise that runs through the system. And of course, there are parallels here with the wider science advice system. This does lead me to one final point on structures. I think, and this is no comment on Patrick personally, but I do think there are some risks involved in giving the role of the GCSA a stronger role in the architecture and design of the funding system. And I know Patrick's wearing a different hat, as it were, when he's doing this role from his day job in the Government Office for Science. But, you know, we've obviously come through a period in which the scrutiny being applied to science advice systems has reached unprecedented levels. I have a mug here with Chris Whitty on it, which I certainly wouldn't have been able to purchase 4 years ago. We all know that. You've lived through that more than any of us, Patrick. But I think, you know, at a time when those systems and structures are under scrutiny, one has to be quite careful to avoid not actual conflicts, but perceptions of conflict, should we say, between advisory functions and functions that then influence the spending of money in various directions. You know, we can all imagine and think through the sorts of possibilities that may emerge, if not now, in future years. So I just think that needs quite careful thought, that line, because it does bring some risks as well as opportunities. That's my first set point. My second set point is really just about the balance between the competitive and the collaborative elements of the roles that Patrick set out, and the sort of dance that's very familiar again in research policy between the soft and hard power of science and technology, the benefits that flow from international collaboration, and then a more hard-edged view of our competitive position, our strategic advantages, as Patrick described it. These arguments, again, are old, long-standing arguments. And of course, strategic advantage takes many forms. I do, reading the integrated review, as I did, have read several times since it came out, it does feel that we are shifting in the pendulum in a visible way more towards that sort of hawkish view of the world, Britain's place in the world, and then the role of S&T in securing and protecting or maintaining Britain's place in the world. That may be entirely correct and legitimate, and of course it's always difficult in these security debates, the asymmetry between those of us that see all the intelligence material and those that don't. But it is quite a shift, and I just worry a bit that we are, notwithstanding the strand on collaboration, we seem to be giving much more political attention, at least, to the competitive side of all this. And I'm thinking, of course, of our relationship with China, of course, the persistent uncertainty of where we stand with Horizon Europe, etc. So it's not to say that this is not necessary and right, but it just, again, in terms of what's visible and available, it feels like a shift is underway. And I think there is a tension, of course, between the view of many in the research community Ben Johnson, the former advisor, I don't know if Ben is there in the audience, but he described this very well. I'm going to quote from him in a piece he wrote in Research Fortnight when George Freeman took over as minister. He talked about this growing chasm between the research community's naive belief, as he described it, that the arc of history is bending towards a Star Trek future of global cooperation, and the government's stance, which he's described as more Han Solo than Jean-Luc Picard. And you get the drift. In the room that you're in, assuming you're in the main RS room, 10, 12 years ago now, when I was director of science policy, we did a lot of work on science diplomacy, and we had a big meeting that led to this, and the FCO then appointed its first science advisor. And of course, what we see in all of this is a different take on that balance. We have had a policy emphasis that's been more tilted towards a science diplomacy type frame, and we're now moving to a more competitive frame, or at least that's how it feels. And I just think that, again, just needs more open public reflection, as it were, within the community and elsewhere. There's an interesting final point I'll make, a sort of quick point of comparison in the US. I chaired a few weeks ago for the OECD a public conversation with Taran Chabra, who's Director for Technology and National Security for the White House National Security Council. And just a couple of interesting points that came for that, for this debate. First, he, speaking from the White House side, saw the OSTS as his direct counterpart in terms of now talking to the UK. And I just thought that was quite interesting, going back to my earlier point about the role of the science minister and BEIS and other structures that we have. And the second point, he talked in his speech, or in remarks he gave at the OECD, about a big push that the Biden administration was making with respect to what he called democracy-affirming technologies. This idea of using the US's strengths in global science technology networks as a collaborator as well as a competitor to advance technologies that in some way or another shored up the normative underpinnings of democracy in the Western world. Of course, one could push and critique that concept, but it, as I say, takes us into the realm of thinking a bit more broadly and holistically about what strategic advantage constitutes in the world of 2022. And another thing I'd point to is Wellcome Trust did this very nice report a few years ago now, and I think again in the context of Brexit, but it was broader on what they called a blueprint for dynamic oversight. And within that, they were talking about this balance, but there was a big emphasis on the UK's leadership role in certain aspects of the soft governance of science and technology. The fact that there are, of course, some technologies that you want to give away for good strategic advantage. One thinks of the whole net zero agenda as well, of course, of vaccines and everything that's gone on there. So I'm sure Patrick will reassure me that all of this is well being thought of and dealt with, but it just does feel that the balance is shifting a bit, and it would be good, I think, to discuss that. Final, very quick point, the balance between, I'm going to quote from another Royal Society report, that the last one that I was involved in setting up before I left the RS, the notion of intelligent openness and strategic secrecy. And I think obviously in and around the OSTS, you've got all of these different interests in terms of defence, security, etc. And of course, one understands the need for secrecy and for that whole side of the R&D system. That part of the system, of course, does sit somewhat removed from the part that many of us inhabit in universities and elsewhere. And I do, again, just think we need to think quite hard about how the two cultures, as it were, in that respect, mix and where the tensions lie. I do worry that we see, again, a move in certain places. I don't think this is yet something I'd accuse the OSTS of, but if we look, for example, at ARIA, which I know is not the subject of debate tonight, to set up a new public body in the way that the government's now doing, without any of the normal mechanisms of accountability. I mean, it's gone through, you know, lots of debate about this in both the Commons and the Lords, and has come out sort of intact with this structure, I think is a very retrograde step. I don't really understand the argument that says something like that needs to be exempt from freedom of information legislation. So again, I know that's not the topic, but I think this whole balance between soft and hard power, between open and closed, between competition, collaboration, is obviously at the absolute heart of science policy, research policy debates for the next probably our lifetimes, but also does need greater discussion and a bit more open debate in our own system about how we strike the right balance. I hope that's a helpful one, intended as a constructive contribution to what I'm sure will make a very positive contribution over the next few years. Thank you.